I'm now with the Natural Resources Defense Council. NRDC, for those who don't know, is one of the nation's biggest environmental organizations, but we're actually much broader than that. We've got a really robust health program that I'm part of, and we use science, advocacy, and policy, as well as legal strategies to bring about a better, more sustainable environment and one that's healthier for us as well. Let's see. Nothing to disclose. I want to change gears a little bit because this is more of a conceptual talk rather than do what the previous speakers did and kind of dig into what we think of as sustainable. I want to talk more about who decides or how do we decide what sustainable is or how it's applied. And the way I think about this is in terms of public goods or common goods. And what is that? Who does decide? Is sustainability of our food supply a common good? I think that one's kind of self-evident, but let me just kind of go back to the beginning and just posit that we'd all agree, I think, that it's good for our country to feed itself, right? That's pretty undebatable. And I think it's also pretty undebatable that if we think it's good to feed ourselves now, it's also good to feed ourselves into the future, which is what food security is about. And so how can we bring that about as a national goal unless we talk about the sustainability of that effort? Marion Nestle, many of you know, she's long been involved with the food and nutrition section, has a really well-traveled blog, and she talked recently, just last month, about the bizarre, she called it the bizarre saga of the 2015 dietary guidelines, and she pointed to two things. One was this fairly unprecedented, I think, blog by the secretaries of HHS and USDA of agriculture, you know, just putting out there that sustainability was not going to be addressed in the dietary guidelines. And then, but then she points to two things. One is the former Deputy Secretary of Agriculture, Kathleen Merrigan, publishing an article last month in Science that we're going to see arguing in favor of a sustainable diet. And also Michelle Simon, another colleague from APHA. Yeah? Oh, great. Thank you. And also Michelle Simon, a colleague of ours, did an analysis, a legal analysis that kind of complements Kim's presentation on not only that sustainability has been included in previous dietary guidelines, but that legally, and in contravention of what Secretary Vilsack said, there's no legal issue why it can't be included in the dietary guidelines. And I won't go into all her arguments, but it's worth a look-see. And so Marianne's conclusion was, this isn't really about science. This is about politics. And it's really not news that much of what goes on around the food system is about politics in addition to science. So here's that article from Kathleen Merrigan and Kim Rovian and others, Bill Dietz. And I just highlighted that last piece that we discussed, the need to incorporate sustainability into dietary guidelines and political maneuvering underway to excise it, which is mainly what I'm focusing on. So good going, Kim, to prefigure my talk. And then Marion actually clued me into something that I hadn't fully paid attention to, a newish group called the Nutrition Coalition, which apparently, she reported, has spending up to $200,000 leading up to congressional hearings on the dietary guidelines and to communicate its critique of the process and to advocate instead for USDA and HHS to turn the guidelines over to a committee of the National Academy of Sciences before releasing them to the public. And again, Marion's remark, really? Eating fruits and vegetables and not overeating calories requires this much lobbying? Apparently it does, because this too is about politics. So who's the Nutrition Coalition? This is part of what they're saying, that the science is not settled. And in fact, it's an interesting group. As I said, they're new. They've only been around for a couple of years. And their funding solely comes from one foundation called the Laura and John D. Arnold Foundation, and specifically their Action Now initiative. The governing board is just three people, an investigative journalist, Nina Teicholz, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, and then two academics. The first one, Nina, is the author of a Big Fat Surprise, which a lot of journalists have been calling on their best of 2014 list. Here's the website for that book. And the way they sell the book is that it reveals the unthinkable, that everything we thought we knew about dietary fats is wrong. And she apparently has also gotten funding directly from the same foundation. Now, what I forgot to put the slide in here that I wanted to include, and she went on to draft a very prominent article in the British Medical Journal, basically saying that the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee got it wrong, and saying that she and her book has got it right. And so Mary Nessel, among others, has pointed out that you know, she might have some points, but really what's sort of surprising and irritating to many is her assertion that she as an individual knows better than the Dietary Guidelines Committee. And I think, Ronnie, were you going to mention later about the letter?
I could, or you can mention it right now.
Well, this is relevant to this meeting, too, because many in the food and nutrition section and the environment section are circulating a letter back to the British Medical Journal saying, we disagree with Nina Teicholz, and here's why. And so many of our more prominent APHM members have signed on to it. And who can I direct them to if they're interested in looking at it and signing on to it as well?
Why don't I collect email addresses on the paper in front, and then we can send you something.
So you all are welcome to sign on to that letter to the BMJ as well. So in addition, there is a nutrition science initiative also founded by the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. And what they're saying here is that the dietary goals for the United States were established 40 years ago, and that the data on which they were based are still inconclusive. And they're basically saying that we're doing it wrong, that the scientific enterprise as a whole isn't looking at the right things and isn't collecting the kind of data that would allow for a scientific foundation behind the guidelines that's more conclusive and robust. So I'm less interested in trying to figure out, you know, if I have an expert opinion that's better than these folks or the Dietary Guidelines Committee. I just think the process behind which this is taking place is really interesting. So this is a very well-heeled foundation. And now they, in 2013, gave another $40 million grant to this initiative, which they also launched with a $5 million seed grant. And they're also apparently funding this journalist who wrote a book and then wrote the British Medical Journal. And they're funding a lobbying effort to Congress to get them to hand the dietary guidelines over to the National Academy of Sciences. And so it seems to be very well orchestrated, very well funded, but primarily linked to this single foundation. And so this is John Arnold, who's worth, according to Forbes, about $3 billion, got his first billion or so from Enron and trading commodities, and now he is doing philanthropy. And you can look on the website about what their goal is. And so, you know, I kind of agree with Maureen Ogle, another author of a recent book, who said battles over the production and consumption of meat are nearly as ferocious as some of these other major policy battles, and just as political, I might add. So let's flip gears from the dietary guidelines and talk about and the influence on the consumption side, and talk about the other side of the meat supply chain, the production side. Because there, it's a different set of actors involved, and often it's the meat producers themselves or the processors or both. Meat's big business, no surprise, right? The value just of the beef that we consume in the U.S. alone, what they call the retail equivalent value, about $95 billion a year. I couldn't find the equivalent number for pork or chicken, but obviously that just adds to the numbers. We produce 93 billion pounds of meat and poultry yearly. That's 2012. And a substantial, and I think maybe even a rising amount, is for export. And so you know how the U.S. is in some cases funding palm oil so that it can be exported out of the countries of origin to places like the U.S. Meat's quite the reverse. Other countries and the U.S., these companies in the U.S. are funding production of meat and all its attendant environmental impacts in the U.S. for, and in many cases, that's for export abroad. So that's something to think about. And really, it's just a few companies in each sector, and increasingly so. So it's not just big meat, it's ever bigger meat. So four companies control about 83% of U.S. beef processing and production. You'd think Tyson's was a poultry company. It's also one of the top four beef companies. You'd think Cargill was a turkey company and a grain processor. It's also one of the top four beef producers. Similarly, four companies control two-thirds of U.S. pork production. Just two companies control 40% of chicken meat. And these are all from a great book, or an author of a great book called The Meat Racket, as well as this article. I'm going to skip over grain, but suffice it to say that if you just talk about meat, you forget that most of the grain in the U.S. is actually either used to produce biofuels or being put into meat production. Anyway, looking at the course of the last year, let's hear what Big Meat had to say about this whole process we discussed earlier. Here, the president of the North American Meat Institute said the committee's foray into the murky waters of sustainability is well beyond its scope and expertise. It's like having a dermatologist make recommendations about cardiac care. Or the National Pork Producers saying that the advisory committee had neither the mandate nor the breadth of expertise needed to do this topic justice. Or here the American Association of Meat Processors said, in response to the anemic recommendations to eat 4 months of red meat, we just say, hands off my hot dog. And you saw that they had a campaign to collect signatures. I think they got about 2,600 petition signers. Oh, why did it do that? Okay. So who does have the expertise? If the advisory committee doesn't, apparently it's 30 members of the Senate who signed this letter giving similar messages back to USDA on the advisory committee, or the 71 members of the U.S. House who signed a similar letter. And these basically said the same thing that the Appropriations Committee signaled in December of last year, which is that we don't want sustainability as part of the dietary advisory recommendations. Well, it's interesting. The Center for Science and the Public Interest then did an analysis of the funding of the members that signed these two letters. And what they found is that across both parties and across the Senate and the House, total money from food company interests to members of the Appropriations Committees was $1.46 million. If you just look at the letters, total, those industries donated $3.1 million+ over a year period. The 30 Senate signers alone received more than $1 million, at least half of which was for the beef and cattle industry. And the 71 House signatories received more than $2 million. And so back to my initial question, and I'll wrap up then. If we think about the commons, this is where the commons came from. In the New England villages, you probably know this. This was the common area in the middle of town that anybody could bring their animals to graze upon. It was seen as a common resource. And it's relevant because the meat industry, unlike many of our other industries, can't really be divorced from the health and resilience of the natural world and the resources that go into it. So the soil and the microbes and the water resources in these and other areas of food production in the U.S., I would argue, are part of our public commons, because without them, we all are going to suffer. And the tragedy of the commons is a phenomenon that when you have a limited resource, like our water, like soil fertility, and one industry or one group of entities overuses it to the detriment of everybody else, you have this tragedy set up. And so NRDC, for instance, has written about how poorly regulated water pollution is degrading surface and groundwaters as a public good while threatening public health. Similarly, 70% of all our medically important antibiotics are used not to treat sick people, but fed to livestock and poultry, often in the absence of any disease. And this helps create reservoirs of antibiotic resistance. I would argue that having effective antibiotics, too, is a public good linked to meat production. And so the tragedy of the commons is occurring there as well. So let's think about it. Who guards our commons? Who defines terms like sustainability or healthy diets? Should it be the USDA? Should it be the Nutrition Coalition? Should it be a muckraking journalist? Should it be Walmart or McDonald's? Why am I bringing up the last two? And this is where I'll end. There's a real threat of greenwashing if we have some of these huge corporate entities deciding what a sustainable food supply is or a meat supply. This is the Global Roundtable of Sustainable Beef founding organizations. You see several of our top four beef producers, Cargill, JBS, as well as one of the leading chemical companies, the biggest fast food retailer in the world, along with one of the biggest chemical companies, and then the biggest retail company. And that's the Global Roundtable on Sustainable Beef. Well, and they've set up principles defining what they mean by sustainable beef production. What's missing is really much public health, no public health representation or participation, only one environmental group, World Wildlife Fund, very little transparency. These principles came out without any vetting from a broader group other than the ones participating. No, as far as I can tell, limits on whether or not or how corporations with direct financial conflicts of interest can participate. And from my perspective, no mention of antibiotics or antibiotic resistance, which is very relevant to the sustainability of the meat supply. And so I'm just going to end there and went a little bit over, but we have some time for questions. I'm going to call the rest of the panel up, and I think Ronnie is going to moderate the Q&A.